Timothy Geithner's answer to global economic stress?
We will replace the current program with a new financial stability plan designed to stabilize and repair the financial system and to support the flow of credit that is necessary for recovery.
And what we need now is something to recover from Geithner.
A great way to calm yourself down in about 30 seconds or less is to try alternate nostril breathing. It's been shown to calm
the markets seeking inner peace after a day of high anxiety. Geithner to the rescue or alternate nostril breathing?
So if you're feeling too anxious, it'll help bring you down to center and chill you out.
Choose your bailout on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, Wednesday, February 11th. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is away. Today, we're going to take a look at the revised bailout plan, the status of the Israeli elections, and just how centered is Washington today. The Obama administration's use of the state's secret privilege is also our focus this morning. Those stories coming up, but first, headlines. Lawmakers will hunker down again today to figure out the final version of the economic stimulus bill. The version passed yesterday by the Senate is bigger than the one passed earlier by the House. President Obama says they need to figure it out soon.
We cannot afford to wait. We can't wait and see and hope for the best. I believe in hope, but I also believe in action.
He was speaking in Fort Myers, Florida, part of his campaign to appeal directly to the people for support of the stimulus. Today, a construction site in Springfield, Virginia. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner received an earful of criticism on Capitol Hill after unveiling the revised financial bailout plan. Wall Street fell steeply after the announcement yesterday. Most Asian markets followed suit this morning. And executives who've already received some bailout funds will testify before the House today. They're expected to say the cash infusions helped them make more loans. Mark Garrison's here with the rest of the headlines. What am I missing, Mark?
Thank you, John. There's more testimony today. A top executive of a peanut corporation will appear before Congress as well. The company's at the heart of a probe into the salmonella outbreak that has sickened hundreds. The FDA says the company's Georgia plant knowingly shipped tainted goods. Also, at least 8 people are dead after a tornado tore through southern Oklahoma last night. It's unusual to have a tornado this early in the year. They generally occur in the spring or the early summer in the U.S. Overseas, Taliban fighters attacked several government buildings in Kabul earlier today. At least 25 people have died and dozens more were wounded. The attacks come just ahead of a visit by Richard Holbrooke, the American special envoy to the region. The votes are in for Israel's general election, but the outcome remains uncertain. Both Foreign Minister Zippy Livni, the centrist, and former Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, are claiming victory. They now begin the process of persuading smaller parties to join them in a coalition.
And the horse trading shall begin. Yes, indeed.
You got it. Also, one other thing, speaking of changes of leadership, Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe has sworn in his longtime rival, Morgan Tsvangirai, as the country's prime minister. Mugabe is still president, though, so we'll see what happens with that so-called unity government.
Yes, so the team of rivals. Government, I think we would say. The S&P begins trading at 827. As we mentioned, Wall Street closed down yesterday. The S&P was down almost 5%. Congress is still working out the massive economic stimulus bill, but we're mobilizing you. If the money flew from D.C. directly into your hands, what shovels would you watch? How would you spend it? What in your town desperately needs the money? Give us a suggestion for infrastructure or your own personal infrastructure. Where's the biggest bang for your buck and who's going to give it to you? Tell us your idea at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Shovel watchers, that's you.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, February 11th, and I have to say my heart goes out to Timothy Geithner this morning. Imagine him getting up, eating his breakfast, looking at the headlines. Not terribly positive reviews of his unveiling yesterday, his financial bailout, $2.4 trillion of a financial bailout plan. And then maybe he turned to the stock pages and noticed that the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell almost 400 points, the S&P down 5%. Yes, that was reaction from Wall Street. We're not interested in piling on necessarily, but we have our own reaction here on The Takeaway. Peter Morici joins us from the University of Maryland. He's a business and economics professor who has already declared that the economic downturn constitutes a depression. Peter Morici, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
And from a distressed municipality, according to the federal government, is Mayor John Fetterman. He's mayor of Braddock, Pennsylvania, which is probably experiencing much more severe than a depression. If you look at the statistics over the last couple of years in Braddock, Pennsylvania, just outside of Pittsburgh. John Fetterman, mayor of Braddock, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, one thing I want to mention at the outset, apparently you're awaiting your own personal stimulus package. Your wife is about to have a baby. Is that right, John?
Yes. Last evening was stimulating because she had some contractions and we weren't sure there. But so far, no delivery, but promise of aid forthcoming shortly.
All right. Well, the welcome wagon will have a basket for you. And if the federal government was going to deliver something of concrete value to a city like Braddock, Pennsylvania, where unemployment is way up. It's been in double digits for years, right?
Oh yeah, no, many multiples above the standard unemployment rate, Braddock, we're not suffering more as a result of this per se. We've suffered over the last 30 to 40 years dramatically, and I think Braddock is useful as an example in this particular climate for two reasons. One, as a cautionary tale of what can happen if a region or a community is allowed to fail, quote unquote, but also the benefit that could be bestowed on a community through the stimulus and bailout package.
All right. Peter Morici, Timothy Geithner yesterday on Capitol Hill suggested that $2.5 trillion is all that it would take to get both the public and private sector working together to buy up toxic assets and also to re-stimulate the lending in the economy. How would that work exactly based on what you heard yesterday?
Well, if anything, we don't really know how it will work. I mean, yesterday we got a very vague program, frankly, I don't think that this program will come to fruition. I think it's going to be dramatically changed because it's wholly inadequate. You know, President Obama says economists are in agreement that we need a stimulus package. Well, if you read the economist's reaction in the Wall Street Journal this morning, we seem to have professional consensus that this is a dog.
Well, let's talk specifics, though, because, the blunt reaction of the markets yesterday was very, very negative, and a lot of people were using all kinds of, sarcastic remarks. Let's talk about it. Geithner wants to take
specifics.
Let me give you one.
Okay.
Geithner said yesterday $500 billion or so would be used from the federal treasury, from the rest of the TARP, or wherever he's going to get it, to start a private-public lending facility that's going to bypass the banks and go directly to small businesses and consumers. How would that work?
Well, essentially, it would permit banks and other institutions to bundle loans that they make into bonds and sell them to the Fed, and the Fed would hold them and sell them to private investors. That's what it's been doing already with auto debt and consumer debt, and that can continue and be expanded. That's not where the problem area is. The problem area, or the greatest problem area, because that wasn't specifically sorted out, is sweeping the bad assets off the banks of the books of the banks. Paulson ran into trouble buying the bad bonds because he couldn't put a value on them. And now Geithner's saying he's going to establish some sort of private-public fund to do the same thing using private entities, which is the same problem Paulson had. He's not stepping up to the plate and creating a bad bank and just taking them off their books at their mark-to-market value, making Wall Street unhappy.
So, Mayor Fetterman of Braddock, Pennsylvania, if the Feds were actually going to make a bad bank, maybe the place to locate it would be in your town, Braddock.
We don't have a bank in our town, and it used to really get under our skin for a while. But now with everything going on, maybe that's a blessing in disguise. But I want to get back to this whole point. I'm old enough to remember when there was national outrage when the Pentagon paid $600 for a toilet seat and $400 for a hammer, and there's no perspective anymore. It's like, you yourself said, well, wherever they come up with that $500 billion, and it's like, $1 billion, what does that mean anymore? All these things are coming out of this weird star chamber kind of atmosphere where, AIG gets $70 billion over the weekend, but we don't mention that, and that's not included in the TARP amount. It just...
Well, Mayor, let's
no transparency here.
So, can I address that?
Sure, go ahead.
Can I address that? There are $11 trillion in outstanding mortgages in the United States. There are many more trillion dollars of outstanding auto loans and credit card debt and all that. The markets are facing a prospect of the banks losing about $2 trillion. So it's going to take at least $500 billion to remove the questionable mortgages from the books of the banks. We did that during the savings and loan crisis. You might not feel it's just and proper, and it isn't really just, but
no,
it's necessary or you won't have a bank in your neighborhood
that can
make a loan.
All right, well, hold on, both of you. Listen to this then and see if this mechanically begins to address what both of you are talking about here. Here's Timothy Geithner talking about small businesses benefiting from his new program.
Because small businesses are so important to our economy, we're going to take some additional steps to make it easier for them to get credit from community banks and from large banks. By increasing the federally guaranteed portion of Small Business Administration loans, and by giving more power to the SBA to expedite loan approvals, we believe we can turn around the dramatic decline in SBA lending we've seen in recent months.
Peter Morici, is someone trying to get a loan in Mayor Fetterman's town, Braddock, Pennsylvania, likely to get a different response based on this remark from Timothy Geithner and the program being implemented?
With all due respect, I'm more qualified to answer that.
We
couldn't get loans before the bailout or the meltdown. So that's not really going to change. And just being talked down to, I do have an MBA, and I did have a master's in public policy. I understand that there's a lot of bad assets out there, but I'm less concerned with what the investment banks and these folks think right now in terms of what we think we should do when they're the ones that got us into this mess.
I don't want to go easy on those guys, Mayor. I don't want to go easy on those guys. I'm all in favor of sweeping the loans off and sweeping. This guy hasn't been on the radio with me before, has he? And sweeping the executives out with him. I want to clean up Citibank. What I want to do is take the bad assets off their books, throw them in the East River along with Vikram and his officers, and get small town bankers in there.
All right, so
Citibank shouldn't exist anymore. It's like, how will we ever know who won the Super Bowl?
All right, guys, both of you, hold on 1 second. Mayor Fetterman and Peter Morici. I mean, those bankers, including Mr. Vikram Pandit of Citigroup, they're all going to be on Capitol Hill talking about their bonuses and some of their decisions they've made over the last 18 months. What do you want to hear from those bankers with your Harvard MBA, John Fetterman?
Well, I don't want to hear anything from them. It's like I'm not interested in what they have to say anymore. I don't, having them flogged, and by the same people that helped contribute to the crisis, on the public policy side, it offers little comfort. The fact that they feel like they still have a place at the table and that they're still lobbying and they're still advertising. I mean, last fall during the election, Citigroup commercials ran nonstop. How it's the city that never sleeps. Meanwhile, they were imploding.
So, all right, Mayor, let me get a comment from Peter Morici.
Well, like it or not, they're in their jobs, and we have to work with them. People in his town would be able to get loans more easily under this program, and I expect that to happen. I expect there to be more SBA loans, and I expect his banks to have more money to lend. I expect that aspect of the program to work more effectively. What I don't expect is for the big banks to get stabilized. And unfortunately for you, the big banks, the big, say, 10 New York banks, have more than half the deposits in the country. And therefore, we're going to have to figure out a way to salvage them, or their depositors are going to be very disappointed. The FDIC can't cover it all. We're going to have to save those banks, even if we cashier out the guys that took the big bonuses.
That's just a part of what's at stake. Always a pleasure. Peter Morici, University of Maryland business professor, thank you. And John Fetterman, contributing to that lively discussion, mayor of Braddock, Pennsylvania, thank you for joining us. And the mayor is about to welcome a new baby into the community of Braddock, a distressed municipality, according to the federal government, thanks to John Fetterman. We're going to be paying attention as the markets will, as the bankers face the music in Congress in front of Barney Frank's committee on Capitol Hill. A confident message from the bankers? We'll find out.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. So what if, all right, what if buried in the 800 and whatever stimulus package that's working its way through Congress, there was a little teeny-weeny piece of it with your name on it? How would you spend it?
Hi, Cheryl from West Caldwell, New Jersey. I totally think that our town needs a multi-million dollar football field with new turf and lights and the whole nine yards.
The whole 100 yards. What in your town desperately needs the money? Your roads, your schools, your infrastructure, personally or otherwise? Call us with your idea for the stimulus package in your neighborhood. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. So there's an election in Israel. The voting has concluded. They're still counting some of the votes, but if you followed recent history in Israel, it's hardly a surprise. There's no conclusive result. Nobody knows really who won. The main contenders are claiming victory. Tzipi Livni, who heads the centrist Kadima Party, has called on her main opponent, Benjamin Netanyahu, of the right-wing Likud Party, to join her in a national unity government. But neither Likud nor Kadima will have enough parliamentary seats to govern alone. So the horse trading begins as the coalition trading begins between all of the parties. To learn more about the election results and where Israel goes from here, we spoke with the BBC's Robin Lustig earlier this morning. He's the host of BBC's NewsHour, and he joined us from the BBC's Jerusalem Bureau. And when we spoke, I asked Robin if the Israelis were surprised by this result.
Well, surprised and not surprised. They knew it was going to be close because that's what the opinion polls told them. They hoped they would have a result. I mean, this is the kind of election you get the results, and as you were saying, you still don't know who won. You've got one seat alone separating the two main parties. The way things stand, there's still a couple of hundred thousand more votes to be counted, so it may change. But the way things stand, Kadima have 28 seats in the 120-seat parliament, and Likud have 27. That is just so close. It's a dead heat, and nobody knows whether it's going to be Tzipi Livni or Benjamin Netanyahu who's going to form the next government.
Robin, at the very least, it appears that the recent Gaza war has solidified or at least reversed what appeared to be seriously negative feelings on the part of the Israeli people towards Kadima in the wake of Ehud Olmert's kind of corruption collapse. The outcome for Tzipi Livni, it appears, would be a reaction to the Gaza war by most Israelis.
That seems to be the case, John, certainly. That's the way it looks to the commentators here this morning. She also ran a very good campaign. There's quite a lot of evidence that she did particularly well among women voters. I was out at a polling station yesterday morning talking to voters as they went in to vote, and a lot of the women said they were going to vote for Tzipi Livni because they wanted to see a woman as prime minister. The other thing we need to bear in mind, if you look at Israeli politics just as a right-wing bloc of parties and a left-wing bloc of parties, it is the right-wing bloc which have done better. Likud, for example, has more than doubled the number of seats that it has in parliament. So yes, Tzipi Livni and Kadima did well, partly because of the way they were seen to have been strong in Gaza, but the right have done particularly well.
Now, Ariel Sharon, when he won as part of a right-wing coalition years ago, attempted to form a right-wing government and had great, great difficulty, which is why Kadima came about, that it was much more practical to run Israel from a center-right coalition as opposed to a right-wing coalition. If Likud is given the chance to start a government or to form a government, what are the challenges of fitting the ultra-right wing with Likud in actually making something manageable here?
Well, that is a real tough one because there are so many permutations. You look at the numbers and you add them up in different columns and you come to several different answers. One of the newspapers this morning laid out five different scenarios of the kind of coalition that Likud could put together. What Mr. Netanyahu would like to do, I think, is put together a broad-based centre-centre-right kind of government. There are quite a lot of people here who think that when all the argy-bargy is over, when all the negotiations are over, you'll have a government in Israel which has Mr. Netanyahu as Prime Minister, but which includes Kadima in it, with Tzipi Livni serving maybe as Foreign Minister underneath Bibi Netanyahu.
It would appear that the argy-bargy there is an attempt to keep Israel Beitanu, the party of Avigdor Lieberman, which gained 15 seats and is an ultra-right-wing party, from actually having a role in the government. Describe the result for Israel Beitanu.
Well, it's a good result for Mr. Lieberman. He very much set the agenda during the campaign. He campaigned on a very simple slogan, which was no citizenship without loyalty. The proposal that all the Israelis associate with him is that all Israeli citizens, whether Jews or not Jews, should be made to swear an oath of loyalty to Israel as a Jewish state. And that if they weren't prepared to do that, and this was seen very much as being aimed at the non-Jewish Arab minority in Israel, which is about 20% of the population, if they refused to swear such an oath of loyalty, they wouldn't be allowed to vote, they wouldn't be considered as citizens of Israel. Now, that's a very controversial proposal. Some people described it almost as a fascistic proposal, but he did make a lot of running. People who were traditional Likud supporters moved towards him. A lot of young voters moved towards him. He's seen as a fresh face. He's seen as somebody who says what he means and who is a strong man. I don't know whether he's going to be in government, though. He has been in government before. Don't forget that. He resigned because he didn't like the idea of withdrawing from Gaza. But he is very much the kingmaker at the moment.
Finally, Robin, is there a message here? And I'm wondering if there's a particular individual who may have the message for Barack Obama, which is poised, the U.S. administration is poised to get more involved in the peace process. Is there a partner here for the new Obama administration, quickly before we go?
The conventional wisdom in Israel is that the Obama administration privately would much rather deal with Tzipi Livni than with Bibi Netanyahu. Under the Clinton administration, when Mr. Netanyahu was prime minister before, they didn't get on terribly well, but they're just going to have to wait and see. Barack Obama's just going to have to wait and see what happens here.
Waiting and seeing for us. That was the BBC's Robin Lustig, who joined us from Jerusalem. He's host of the BBC's NewsHour. And now Mark Garrison has the headlines.
Thank you, John. 28 minutes after the hour, negotiators on Capitol Hill are hoping for a final compromise on the economic stimulus package today. There's desire to bring the bill under $800 billion. Yesterday, the Senate approved an $838 billion economic stimulus bill. That is bigger than the House version that passed a while back. Three moderate Republican senators helped push the Senate bill through. Now they're demanding the final compromise look more like the Senate measure. And today also, CEOs from Bank of America, Citigroup, and more will go before Congress to defend how their companies used federal bailout funds. In a prepared statement, aid execs say the hundreds of billions of dollars helped them make more loans. They also say their staffers took big pay cuts last year and no government money went for bonuses. Last week, a government watchdog group criticized the bailout. A report said the banks got more money than their assets were worth from the Treasury Department. A decision on additional U.S. troop deployments to Afghanistan could come soon. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says he expects President Obama to decide on a number of new American troops in the next few days. John.
An actual number. So there's a surge.
Yeah, they're talking about doubling it, basically, but they're going to make that more specific.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Out of the $2.5 trillion that Timothy Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, spoke about yesterday, either in financial bailout money or in stimulus money and loan money, is there a teensy-weensy bit that could be carved off for a project in your neck of the woods? How should stimulus plan money or new loans be spent? Does your town need a new hospital, a new industry? What is it that's in your neighborhood that would get people you know back to work? Or does your family need health insurance or maybe a new car? Tell us where you live and what you need at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're putting together our own shovel-ready series of projects for the Obama administration. So if you've heard of television series called To Catch a Predator, it used to be the Dateline program on NBC News, NBC is hunting for someone besides predators. They're actually looking for war criminals. The network is reportedly working on a series about international war criminals actually living in the United States. And it's due to air this month or next. And one of the first investigations involves a Maryland college professor who the network claims participated in the 1994 Rwandan genocide. A letter from the network to the university led to the school suspending the professor. Brian Stelter, a media reporter for The New York Times, joins me in the studio this morning. You've written on this project that is in the works at NBC. It's modeled after To Catch a Predator, which is all about sex offenders. But what about it raises interesting issues in terms of television journalism for you?
What surprised the human rights advocates and the federal officials that I talked to yesterday was that NBC was traveling to this college campus and presumably to other places in the company of a foreign government official. And so in this case, a prosecutor from the Rwandan government who was traveling with NBC, showing an indictment that that country had produced and signed for the arrest of this professor in this case.
And using hidden cameras like To Catch a Predator and basically creating a stakeout scene?
Yeah, not hiding them per se, but showing up with a big crew coming into the classroom, something that, you know, you would call an ambush interview, even though they did have some notice. It seemed like it wanted to be an ambush, in the words of one of the college officials.
Now, NBC, of course, experienced a good degree of success and controversy on the To Catch a Predator brand. Mm-hmm. What is their response to your reporting?
Their response now is that they are in the middle of news gathering and they won't comment during the news gathering process. They say they are doing this investigation, have been doing it for more than a year, about alleged war criminals and terrorists who are living in the United States, and that any contact with foreign governments is consistent with their acceptable journalistic practices.
All right, so what could be wrong with trying to assist prosecutors in a place like Rwanda to find and catch and expose people living comfortably in the United States who are alleged to have been involved in war crimes?
Yeah. Essentially, the officials I was talking to are saying, why is NBC taking on this role of acting as this investigator? Why isn't the Rwandan prosecutor in this case going through official government channels?
Well, who cares whether NBC is doing it or the Rwandans are doing it by themselves? So what's wrong with NBC greasing the skids and assisting in the pursuit of justice here?
What's wrong in the Department of Homeland Security's mind is that these TV crews going out doing their own investigation, which could then perhaps hurt other investigations on a federal level or by other foreign governments. They're worried that by a TV show going out and doing an investigation would prohibit other investigations conducted by prosecutors in the future.
Now, have the Rwandans expressed this concern that NBC would sort of gum up the works and make it difficult for them to pursue their own prosecution?
It's unclear how much cooperation is going on between NBC and the Rwandan government. There's clearly some collaboration if they are traveling together and talking to alleged war criminals and their bosses together.
In the case of To Catch a Predator, there was controversy over the collaboration between NBC and a group called Perverted Justice, which I believe took a fee from NBC.
Right. These people were chatting online with people, essentially luring them in with sexual remarks while pretending to be children, then arranging these meetings that NBC would film and then police would conduct arrests at. And so working both with this private group and these local law enforcement officials, they were able to nab dozens of people, but it raised a lot of ethical issues for NBC in the process.
I mean, in the case of To Catch a Predator, the first individuals that NBC apprehended or exposed were solidly, guilty, or at least seemed so on TV. As time went on, though, you ran out of the low-hanging fruit and you get into cases that were maybe a little more controversial, a little more ambiguous. Do you think that's possibly a pattern here?
Certainly there are people at Human Rights Watch, for example, that say the evidence for this Maryland college professor that he was involved in genocide is insufficient. And they are very highly skeptical of some of the evidence the Rwandan government is presenting. This professor says, look, I'm a political opponent and this government is trying to prosecute me. But not on, you know, these charges are false. He denies all these charges. And so I think that's the slippery slope here. In cases like a Rwandan genocide, the truth is so murky. It's so unclear what actually happened. But in the meantime, when you have any news organization that's working with a government official, it raises a lot of eyebrows in the journalism community.
But raising eyebrows is one thing. Is it possible that this program, if it airs, could have an impact positively on apprehending people who use the United States as a refuge?
It absolutely could. And a lot of local police officials said the same thing about Predator, that these programs were taking criminals off the street. I think the issue that concerns journalistic ethics professors, for example, is that it taints all the material in the process. By having a journalistic organization work with a local law enforcement, or in this case, a foreign government, it taints the entire process.
Quickly, any sense based on your sourcing of whether this is going to air or not?
NBC stands by it for now, and they say it will be seen at the spring.
All right, and possibly under the Dateline, that's their
right.
Magazine
It seems
program.
To be an NBC News project, but even that's unclear.
Thank you, Brian. Brian Stelter, New York Times media reporter, talking about a project still in the works at NBC News to nab war criminals in the same way that alleged sex offenders were nabbed on the program To Catch a Predator. And now with the headlines, we caught Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. 21 minutes before the hour, tornado watches are in effect today for several states. At least 8 people are dead after a cluster of tornadoes tore through southern Oklahoma last night. In Israel, the election is over, and both centrist foreign minister Zippy Livni and conservative leader Benjamin Netanyahu say they won. Livni's Kadima party appears to have won one more seat in parliament than Netanyahu's Likud party, but now is where it gets interesting and also complicated. Talks will go on to see who can form a coalition that will determine the shape of the government, but the math as it stands now points to a right-leaning government taking power. Opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai is now prime minister of Zimbabwe. President Robert Mugabe swore him in this morning. Mugabe has ruled virtually unchallenged for nearly 3 decades. The new so-called unity government will be under pressure to reverse the struggling economy and cholera outbreak, which has killed more than 3,000. 3 trucks are getting low safety marks after recent side crash tests. The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety says to the 2009 Chevy Silverado 1500, Dodge Ram 1500, and Nissan Titan perform badly in side tests. You can actually see video of those tests on our website, thetakeaway.org.
Those are the only people buying trucks, the people who crash them for the tests,
yeah, well,
actually. That's keeping
out.
The entire auto industry going. You know, we also have a trade deficit number that's a sign of the recession.
Yeah.
Yes, the U.S. trade deficit fell to its lowest level in 6 years. That's an indication of the deepening recession, probably mostly because of fuel costs down.
Bet.
Thank you, Mark Garrison.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And let's tick off a few headlines for those of you who may be very concerned about the newspaper business. There's the New York Times attempting to sell its stake to raise cash in the Boston Red Sox, also offering a $250 million stake in the New York Times Corporation to billionaire Carlos Slim of Mexico. There's News Corp, Rupert Murdoch's company, which lost $6 billion or more in the last quarter. Joining us now is Josh Karp, founder and publisher of The Printed Blog. If newspapers are having difficulty making money, how are you finding a way to make money using blog content and actually getting people to pay for it from the world of online journalism?
Well, we're changing the model for newspapers from the ground up. If you look at a newspaper from 1909 and you look at a newspaper from 2009, they look and work largely the same, and we are completely changing the model. We're taking things that are working online and we're bringing them offline. And so far, it looks like we may have a success on our hands.
So there already are business models online for people who so-called aggregate content. You can go to Google News and get that. You're taking it a step further and actually producing a printed digest of online material. Explain how that works and who would pay for it.
Well, right now it works by us going and picking blogs and putting them into this newspaper. But the more important aspect is what's going to happen in 2 or 3 months from now, which is depending on where you pick up the paper, you will be able to go and vote on the content that's important to you. So we are creating these self-selected, very local newspapers. And in terms of who's paying for it, advertisers, both big and small, are very interested in addressing the community. That's why you see bank branches on every corner and insurance agents. Very local newspapers with content that is specific to you. That's very appealing to advertisers, and we're finding appealing to readers as well.
What happens to your business model if bloggers start charging you for the content you're taking from them in this sort of internet public domain environment?
Well, we've already tried to address that in the fact that we do pay our bloggers. The bloggers receive a portion of the ad revenue that appear next to their articles. We are very much about respecting the bloggers' work and the quality of their citizen journalism. So we do pay them, and even in our infancy, we are sending out checks to some of the bloggers, going back to the very first issue.
How do you distinguish between a blogger who's simply making snarky comments about restaurants in their town versus people whose interest seems to be offering factual information and updating that information as news warrants?
Well, right now we have a team of editors that are doing that. But right now we're just trying to show the potential power of this medium. In the future, like I said, the community will vote on what's interesting to it. So if they want to have a snarky restaurant reviewer that writes interesting stories about restaurants in town rather than a local school board administrator who blogs about upcoming school board meetings and issues in the community, that's up to that specific community. My guess is depending on where you live, you're going to see a combination of both big national general interest blogs and very local things that are interesting to one block at a time.
All right. One issue. How much does it cost, Josh, quickly?
It costs us, we're able to make about $1,000 per location per week. And so
what do I pay?
You pay nothing. It's free to pick up at wherever we hand it out.
Purely advertiser supported. All right. Thank you very much. Josh Karp, founder and publisher of The Printed Blog, a new business model for the ailing newspaper industry. He joined us from Chicago. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. We're always up early here on The Takeaway, but lawmakers were out late last night. Mark Garrison is here with the headlines.
You bet, John. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, what they were doing was trying to negotiate a final draft of the economic stimulus bill. The Senate and House passed slightly different bills, a little bit different in money, how it's spread around, but those have to match before the president can sign them into law. They say they may have something final by today. White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel is also involved in the talks. Taliban fighters attacked several government buildings in Kabul earlier today. Dozens have died and dozens more wounded. The attacks come just ahead of a visit from Richard Holbrooke, the new American special envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan. U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says he expects President Obama to make a decision in the next few days about how many new American troops to send to Afghanistan. Gates will meet with the president today. The head of Peanut Corporation of America will appear before Congress today. The company's at the heart of a probe into a salmonella outbreak that has sickened hundreds and is linked to a few deaths. The FDA says the company's Georgia plant knowingly shipped tainted goods. You can see the complete list of recalled products at our website, thetakeaway.org. Australian police are reporting looting in areas devastated by wildfires. They say strangers have been entering burned communities and picking through the wreckage. Right now, arson investigators are looking through. They believe some of the fires were deliberately set. John.
Thank you, Mark. And did you hear Peter Morici and John Fetterman talking at the beginning
lively,
of the
passionate
hour?
Discussion.
Yes, they were very, very lively. And some of you wanted into the discussion out there.
The mayor's right on target. We aren't interested in hearing what the bankers and the investment bankers have to say anymore. I'm actually more interested in a proposal that was offered by Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, where he says, give every family in America that makes under, say, $250,000, give them all one-time check for $250,000. Let them pay off their bad assets, the toxic assets go away, the banks don't have to worry about it anymore, and the banks then have the cash once we've paid the banks back.
The Stewart Plan. Call us anytime with your take on the show. Join the conversation at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. So while campaigning for president, you may recall Barack Obama was extremely critical of the Bush administration's treatment of detainees. But now his administration, the Obama administration, is invoking the state secret privilege, as the Bush administration did, to uphold the dismissal of a federal lawsuit involving extraordinary rendition and torture. With us to discuss it is ACLU staff attorney Ben Weisner, who argued the case for the plaintiffs. Ben, first of all, explain what this lawsuit is. If I'm not mistaken, it's a suit, among other things, against the Boeing Corporation.
It is a lawsuit against a subsidiary of Boeing that was, according to the New Yorker's Jane Mayer, the CIA's travel agent. This was a corporation that essentially organized all of the CIA's clandestine flights around the world where our clients and other foreign citizens who were abducted off the streets of various countries were chained to the floors of planes, flown to dungeons, really, some in countries like Morocco and Egypt that are notorious for their torture, and others in the CIA's own black site prisons. These people were disappeared, essentially, kidnapped. Their families were not notified. They were not given lawyers. They were not charged with crimes. They were tortured very brutally. Some of them have now been released without being charged, and others are still being held in prisons throughout the world, including Guantanamo.
Now, let's just stipulate for the moment that there may be a case where a government has an interest in extraordinary rendition and taking people to so-called black sites to interrogate them. But for these particular plaintiffs, what is it about their treatment and what happened to them that specifically bears on this case?
Well, actually, I want to take issue with that stipulation. I certainly don't join it. I don't think the government ever has a legitimate interest in abducting someone without any legal process, holding them without charge, and interrogating them without restraint. But at the core of this lawsuit are the torture allegations by our plaintiffs. And they join a growing number of torture victims in various cases who have tried to hold government officials and corporations accountable for what they endured. And not one of them has yet had his day in court. And that's something that people don't realize. The Bush administration and now the Obama administration have used technicalities, really, secrecy claims, immunity claims, in order to keep every single one of these victims out of court.
Well, in this particular case, those claims were upheld by the courts which have ruled very much against the Bush administration on other matters involving detainees. Why in this particular case do state secrets take precedent as far as the federal courts are concerned at this point?
You're asking the wrong person, because I'm also bewildered by the treatment that this lawsuit and other lawsuits have taken. The allegations at the core of these lawsuits are not secret. Our plaintiffs' allegations have been thoroughly aired. They've been investigated by foreign governments. Some of our plaintiffs have already received compensation from other governments for their secondary roles in all of this.
And so the Obama administration, when they went into court under Eric Holder, a very different Justice Department than under George W. Bush, what was the argument that surprised you?
Well, again, this is the same argument that's been used. What surprised us was who was making the argument this time, not the argument itself. And the argument is that, you know, these are critical foreign intelligence programs and that confirming or disclosing any of these details in court could somehow harm national security. But you end up in this very odd situation where the only place in the world where these allegations, where these claims can't be discussed is in a federal court where they most belong. And I will say this about the Obama people. I'm not trying to suggest moral equivalence between an administration that ordered torture serially, that opened black sites, that ran Guantanamo as a gulag all these years, and an administration that ended those. Where we differ with the Obama administration, and this is very critical, is on the question of accountability. And I really think that the administration would rather sweep the last 7 years under the rug and move on and get along. And the problem is that's not how it works in our system. Victims deserve to be compensated. Perpetrators have to be held accountable. And if these cases aren't allowed to go forward, that won't happen.
But isn't it also the case that it is the responsibility of a new administration to protect the secrets as a matter of continuity of previous administrations, whether they disagree with the particular practices of that previous administration?
You know, we're not trying to reveal the identity of the next Valerie Plame here. The question is whether this suit should be allowed to begin. The state secrets privilege can be used during the litigation to block the disclosure of real secrets. Here it's being used at the outset as an immunity doctrine to throw the whole case out. And so if there are genuine secrets involved in our factual allegations, those will be protected during the course of a lawsuit. We're really not trying to harm anybody here.
Well, then what led you to believe that the Obama administration would take a different tack here and basically reverse a pretty longstanding policy of the U.S. government of having state secrets take precedence in these kinds of cases?
Again, it's not a longstanding policy that the state secrets privilege is used to torpedo entire lawsuits before they can get off the ground. That really was an innovation of the Bush regime. And what led us to believe that there would be a change of course is a number of things. Number one, President Obama's commitment to transparency in government, his specific criticism of the overuse and abuse of the state secrets privilege, and then his orders on the 22nd of January to close Guantanamo, to shutter the CIA's black sites, to end the Extraordinary Rendition Program. Without these programs, you know, the need to protect any legitimate or illegitimate secrets that might have happened in the last 7 years seems to me to be eviscerated. I mean, why do we need to preserve the efficacy of a program that the president has abolished as illegal?
Well, what about the case of the Boeing subsidiary? I mean, if the government called you in the night and said, hey, we need a plane, don't ask any questions, just show up at this airport, is that company liable for what happens to those detainees later on?
Well, we're not talking about a company that just supplied a plane and didn't do anything. We're talking about a company that, according to published reports and foreign investigations, filed dummy flight plans for the CIA to conceal what was going on, openly discussed within the company that these were the CIA's torture flights and they were profiting handsomely from this. So they knew what they were doing. And they have an opportunity to defend themselves if we're able to go forward in trial.
And so if we were to go forward in trial, basically the company would have the argument, look, we were working for the CIA, everything's supposed to be secret, and this is what we were getting paid for, period, the end, whereas you would say, no, you should have known that this was a moral issue and that you were basically violating the civil rights of these defendants.
Anyone who is knowingly complicit in a program that transports human beings to dungeons where they're brutally tortured and is making a profit from it, I think should be held accountable. If they have a different view, then we should air that and litigate it in open court.
Ben Wisner, staff attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union, thanks so much. That's the argument he will be yearning to tell in open court. We're talking about the Obama administration upholding the dismissal of a federal lawsuit involving extraordinary rendition and torture. So as we follow the stimulus plan, what should be in it to help you out? Carrie sends us an email. I would love to see a program set up through volunteer programs or tax breaks to help people with overwhelming student loans. I'm paying $500 a month for at least the next 22 years. If I could work off that money through community service or some other way, I could put more money into the market and sleep better at night. Tell us your take at 877-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're always on. Our podcast is to go. You can subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. And while you're listening, you can check back to the lively conversation we had about the financial bailout plan with business professor Peter Morici and John Fetterman, the mayor of the troubled small town outside of Pittsburgh, Braddock, Pennsylvania. After Bernard heard the conversation, he had something to say to bankers.
Enough is enough. Come out clean, say what the law says, and let's move on. If Citibank is not supposed to be in existence anymore, so be it. We're Americans. We can take it, and we'll move on from there.
Well, the bankers will be on Capitol Hill. Stay tuned. Your takeaway comes from Israel this morning.
The conventional wisdom in Israel is that the Obama administration privately would much rather deal with Tzipi Livni than with Bibi Netanyahu.
Memo to Obama from Robin Lustig, host of the BBC's NewsHour. We're enlisting you as reporters to watch the shovels. Go to our website and find out how. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
The Treasury Secretary's New Deal.
a new financial stability plan, new higher standards for transparency, with a new framework of oversight, a new program of capital support, a new funding mechanism, new programs, three new programs, new measures, a new home, a new car. These new requirements, which will be available on a new website.
New, but an old reaction from the markets, down. Tim Geithner lays out trillions and the markets want more. It's just the first inning, digesting a bailout. Sports metaphors, medical metaphors, war metaphors, not included. But we have a new website. We got that going for us on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everybody. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is away. Today, some serious discussion on the revised bailout package before Capitol Hill and a congressional investigation into the salmonella outbreak in peanut butter, and an order to reduce the number of prisoners in California jails has meaning for everyone in the United States. Those stories coming up, but first headlines. What a difference a day makes. Jazz singer Dinah Washington sang about it, and now Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is humming the same tune. I'm telling you, he's talking about the closed-door negotiations to hammer out a final copy of the stimulus bill.
The Speaker and I think we can get a lot of the work done in the first 24 hours. Now, there can be a few things can stall things for a long time, but I think we can get through most of it in the next 24 hours.
Humming away, the White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel is among those representing President Obama in the closed-door talks. The White House made some concessions yesterday, removing about $40 billion in state aid. Meanwhile, the top Republican on the Senate Banking Committee is attacking the Obama administration's new proposal for the financial bailout plan. Alabama Senator Richard Shelby says Treasury Secretary Geithner didn't offer many specifics.
I think on both sides of the aisle in the Senate Banking Committee, people were appalled that he had really nothing to say.
Investors were less than impressed, too. As we mentioned, Wall Street dropped sharply after its unveiling, although the market is poised to open positively this morning. Mark Garrison, what am I missing?
Thank you, John. We've been talking about the bailout plan, and executives who received bailout money from it last fall will testify before the House today. They're expected to say none of the money was used for employee bonuses. The top executive of Peanut Corporation of America will appear before Congress as well. The company's at the heart of a probe into a salmonella outbreak that has sickened hundreds. The FDA says the company's Georgia plant knowingly shipped tainted goods. At least eight are dead after a tornado tore through southern Oklahoma last night. It's unusual to have a tornado this early in the year. Overseas, Taliban fighters attacked several government buildings in Kabul earlier today. At least 27 people have died, dozens more wounded. This just ahead of a visit from Richard Holbrooke, the American special envoy to the region. Also, Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe swearing in his longtime rival Morgan Tsvangirai as prime minister. John.
An election in Israel, no real outcome there. We're figuring out who the coalition
really
will be. And it would normally be good news that the trade deficit is down to the lowest point in almost 6 years, but instead it's actually a sign of the persistent
recession. For the wrong reasons, yeah.
That's right, indeed. Tell us your stories about the stimulus package. If the money was coming to you directly, how would you spend it? Show us what you would do for the infrastructure in your town. And if you see money being spent, tell us how it's being spent. Go to our Shovel Watch at thetakeaway.org or just call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. The president has said it. Economists have said it. We're in uncharted waters. There seems to be something of a consensus that this financial downturn is unprecedented. And so all of the policy considerations you're seeing on Capitol Hill are something of a bet that those policies, those programs, those bailout plans will actually turn things around. You might say, though, the real bet is on what's going to happen in China. China's economy has been sustaining the amount of cash and lending and borrowing that the U.S. and the rest of the world need to stimulate stimulate their economies. The question is, can China continue to do that? The statistic that comes to my mind is the recent unemployment figure in China that suggests there's a downturn there, 26 million or more Chinese people out of work. So to learn more about the Chinese economy and if it's capable of supporting the global economy in this time of stress, we spoke to the BBC's Chris Hogg, who joined us from Shanghai in an interview we conducted earlier this morning. And the first thing I asked Chris was to explain those unemployment numbers and to explain some further numbers that just came out today.
We've had the latest figures for exports and imports. Now, these show that exports, which pretty much tipped off the cliff 3 months ago, they started falling in November. November, December, we saw falls of about to just under 3%. In January, they fell significantly, fell down towards the bottom of the cliff, some people are saying, fell 17.5% from a year earlier.
That's
the
huge.
The plunge in imports was even greater. It was down 43%, twice as bad as the month previously. Now, of course, why this really matters here in China is that the coastal areas in the south of China, those factories that were making exports, goods for export, so many of them are closing now. That's why you've got those 26 million plus migrant workers who have lost their jobs. And there's no sign of an end of this yet.
So what does that mean for the Chinese government? Do they have to devote their resources that they could be using to buy bonds or, you know, securitized assets that Timothy Geithner is talking about here in Washington to something of more of a domestic nature?
They don't have to pull that money out of America. I mean, certainly they have signaled that perhaps in the future they're not going to buy those treasury bonds in as many of them as they were previously. But they do have a certain amount of cash, if you like, here in China already, and they're using that money for their own stimulus package here. But of course, America needs Chinese growth to make sure that they can still keep funding the deficit. The problem is that the exports have tipped off the cliff because people in America aren't buying things made in China anymore. So it's a vicious circle, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, this interrelationship is really why I think the financial crisis is so scary. If the U.S. doesn't buy Chinese goods, they're not going to have the money and the cash to finance both their domestic programs as well as these global borrowing plans that the administration hopes are going to come to fruition. A year ago, we were looking at oil prices above $100 a barrel and Chinese growth at something over 10%. What is Chinese growth now? And if it slips much further, what are the impacts likely to be?
Well, there isn't an easy answer to that question. I mean, certainly in the last quarter, Chinese growth slipped back to 6.8%. But the way that the Chinese calculate growth is different to the rest of the world. The rest of the other major economies calculate growth sort of quarter on quarter, so they compare 3 months with the 3 months previously. The Chinese compare the 3 months with the same 3 months the year before, and so economists can only really estimate just how much China has slowed down by the kind of measure that the rest of the world uses. But the kind of estimates that they're coming up with are pretty scary. They're saying anything from 1.5% to zero, and some people even say that China is in a recession. Now, remember that what most people accept here is that China needs GDP growth of around 8% in order to create enough jobs to keep its population happy. So if in the last few months it slowed down as far as some people are suggesting, there is a real concern that with all these people out of work, that could lead to social problems here.
Well, the numbers are imprecise, but the feelings are very, very distinct in the global economy. That was the BBC's Chris Hogg in Shanghai talking about growth numbers declining in China. Whether they're measurable or not, they have an impact on economic policy here in the United States. And joining us now is Stephen Labaton, reporter for the New York Times, who was paying very close attention yesterday to Timothy Geithner up on Capitol Hill unveiling the Obama administration's version of the financial bailout. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, John.
Now, he talked about $2.5 trillion in total assets that are going to go to a combination of lending and securitizing of assets. First of all, give me your sense of what was clearest about a plan that's already been described by lawmakers as too vague.
Well, the clearest thing is that it's going to be a
a policy on multiple fronts of trying to flood the system on helping credit markets, on helping weak institutions, on helping homeowners, and trying to push, throwing so much against the wall and hoping that enough of it sticks that that it can begin to pull the markets out of the crisis.
Well, there are two components of this, and can you describe them at least? I went through Geithner's testimony again and again yesterday, and it was a little difficult for me to understand what was going on here.
Okay, so you have one big piece of the puzzle going to be a program run largely by the Federal Reserve that's going to try to unfreeze the credit markets by supporting efforts to go in and help commercial paper, auto loans, student loans, credit card loans, and that's a trillion-dollar effort. You have a second effort that's going to try to help to provide new capital, particularly to the biggest banks, and that we don't have a number on. And the way that will work is that there are going to be so-called stress tests taken of the largest banks. They're going to take their current balance books, balance sheets, and look at what might happen if the economy continues to turn down in the 6 months, and do they have the capital to withstand those downturns? And if not, the government is going to say, you're right, try to raise more capital, and if you can't, we will provide it to you with some important and stringent conditions. Then there's going to be a third part, a $50 billion program, to help homeowners themselves facing foreclosure to renegotiate their mortgages. So those are some of the components of the
plan. Let's start with the first one. Here's Geithner describing how he's going to set up this first $1 trillion financing capacity, he called it.
We believe this program should ultimately provide up to $1 trillion in financing capacity, but we plan to start it on a scale of about $500 billion, and we will expand it based on what works.
Now, is that like a down payment, Stephen, where the Feds come up with $500 billion and everybody in the private sector around the world goes, hey, they're in for $500 billion. I want a piece of that action. Is that how it's literally going to work?
Well, the hope is they haven't come up with a calculation for the plan, the so-called bad bank plan, in which they'll buy up toxic assets. So we don't know if it'll be $1 to $1 or how it will work or exactly what the relationship will be. But the concept is that the government, in partnership with investors, private equity funds, hedge funds, other money that's been largely on the sidelines, will begin to look closely at the deteriorating assets and begin to take them off the books of the banks.
All right. Here is a clip from Timothy Geithner yesterday, which I think bears on the issue of style and credibility. Listen to this, and let's talk when we come back.
I want to be candid. This strategy will cost money, it will involve risk, and it will take time. But as costly as this effort may be, we know that the cost of a complete collapse of our financial system would be incalculable for families and for businesses and for our nation.
Now, Stephen Labaton, it sounds like he's saying there we could lose all the banks, and the markets heard that message, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average declined by almost 400 points.
Yes. The concept, though, that he's trying to convey there, and he said it elsewhere in slightly different words, is that during the Great Depression and during Japan's financial crisis and in other places, it's their view and historians' view and economists' view that the governments did not act quickly enough, boldly enough, big enough, and that therefore we need this huge plan, even though a lot of the details are left out, and that's what disappointed Wall Street yesterday. We need a huge plan and do it as quickly. You can't err on the side of being too big, in essence.
Thank you, Stephen. History, of course, is going to show if this will all work. My guest was Stephen Labaton, a reporter for the New York Times, taking a look at the Timothy Geithner financial bailout plan. It really is a new deal. At this point, he outlined $2.4 trillion of money to boost spending and lending on every level, from the Fed all the way down to the Small Business Administration. Time will tell if this works out.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody, and attention, Takeaway listeners. We're asking you to take this fiscal stimulus bull by the horns. I mean, if some of that money came into your hands directly, how would you spend it?
Hey, my name is Charlie. I'm calling from Passaic, New Jersey. If the money were coming in, what I would do is I'd take a certain percentage of it and hire a bunch of independent private investigators to go after the politicians and the guys that stole all the money from us in the first place. How about them apples?
Investigations, a growth industry. Call us with your idea for the stimulus package, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. In Washington today, the House Energy and Commerce Investigation Subcommittee is holding a hearing to examine the recent salmonella outbreak associated with peanut butter manufactured by the Peanut Corporation of America. An extensive investigation into this nationwide outbreak, which now involves the FBI, is concentrating on just who is accountable for letting tainted peanut products from one plant in Blakely, Georgia, contaminate hundreds of other foods. Currently, 8 people have died from salmonella poisoning, and nearly 600 people in 44 states have fallen ill. Joining us to talk about this is Benjamin England. He's a 17-year Food and Drug Administration veteran and founder of FDAImports.com. He's on the line from Columbia, Maryland. Benjamin, thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning, John.
First of all, how does the FDA monitor something like Peanut Corporation of America and particularly the manufacturing site, and what meant that this factory was in a blind spot for so long?
Well, I mean, FDA only monitors facilities like this through inspections, and food facility inspections in the United States, particularly sanitation-based inspections, are pretty low in number compared to what they used to be. So, you know, the issue, I think, is for an answer to that question is just the failure to be in the facility. The FDA is just not in there very often.
And that's a resource question, that there are fewer inspections, or is there some trigger for an inspection that, for some reason, Peanut Corporation of America didn't trip?
No, it's mostly that question is mostly resource. There's no trigger as far as a food inspection.
So basically, the Peanut Corporation of America facilities should have been inspected on a regular basis, and because the funding of the FDA declined during the Bush administration and before, the resources weren't there to do basic oversight.
Yeah, well, the funding issue has been a 20-plus year problem, But yes, the funding has declined. Consequently, the agency is not able to do as many inspections. This place actually was inspected a number of years ago, and some of these issues were actually brought up during the earlier inspections. And I think the state was also in there, the state of Georgia. And either the issues were not observed, or they just were not handled aggressively when they were observed.
You know, given the sense of, sort of homey kind of peanut butter has a pretty benign reputation. You know, if your kids aren't going to eat the chicken or the broccoli, they're definitely going to eat the peanut butter sandwich. And so the idea that peanut butter could actually kill you seems to me to be an unbelievable reversal that the FDA has allowed to happen in terms of confidence in the food supply. How do you reverse something like this?
As far as confidence, I think the way you reverse it is that the agency should certainly be more aggressive with regard to what are called ready-to-eat foods. I mean, when you have a salmonella or any other kind of contamination risk in a ready-to-eat food, you are in a high-risk area because there's no further processing to that product before it's consumed, as opposed to chicken, for instance, where you know, everybody cooks chicken and they've learned enough that there's salmonella on chicken. But it's not even the fact that you're concerned that there might be salmonella or contamination on a food. I mean, bring food out of the ground, you're going to have contamination on it. But if you're buying it at a store in a ready-to-eat condition, then there's a significantly higher risk.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. Does the FDA distinguish between ready-to-eat food where there's no backstop, either cooking or washing, like you would do with produce, cooking, as you mentioned, with chicken, that basically you open a can of peanut butter and whatever's in there, you're going to ingest, period,
right.
The end.
Yeah, and the FDA does distinguish between the two. I mean, I think part of the issue with this peanut incorporation, you mentioned the FBI being involved, and I'm sure the Office of Criminal Investigations. I was an Office of Criminal Investigation investigator myself for FDA, a special agent for FDA for a while. And when you get involved, if it's true that the corporation had knowledge, or that there were folks who were responsible at the company with knowledge that the peanut butter was contaminated and was being sold anyway, it kind of puts this problem into another kind of category. It's not your normal, outbreak, because if you have someone who's going to sell product that's contaminated with salmonella, and knowing so, I think you also have someone who's willing to hide that from investigators and inspectors.
Well,
right?
That's actually a pretty interesting takeaway. I mean, if it turns out that these people are criminally liable for this contamination, it actually, in some sense, makes you feel better about the viability of the entire supply chain, Benjamin England?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, you cannot create a regulatory system, for instance, that prevents crime and fraud. Because it's just they're not designed to do that. So it's not entirely fair to use this as an example of the breakdown of the FDA. Although I think there is a breakdown of the FDA, I just don't think it's a fair example of it.
But he's described the breakdown as a very interesting point about how criminality should cause us a certain amount of reassurance. Benjamin England, thanks so much for joining us. Benjamin England is a 17-year veteran of the Federal Food and Drug Administration and founder of FDAImports.com, and he was speaking to us from Columbia, Maryland. And now headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. Zimbabwe takes what many hope is a step forward starting today. Longtime President Robert Mugabe has sworn in his rival, Morgan Tsvangirai, as prime minister. This comes after months of talks and delay. The elections were nearly a year ago. People on the streets of Zimbabwe have waited a long time for this day. Here's one resident's reaction.
Tsvangirai is going to change everything in Zimbabwe. Everyone is happy. Everyone is happy in Zimbabwe.
Tsvangirai's opposition party prevailed in elections, but Mugabe's forces blocked him for months after. Negotiators on Capitol Hill are hoping for a final compromise on the economic stimulus package today. Yesterday, the Senate approved an $838 billion bill. That's bigger than the House version. Three moderate Republican senators helped push the Senate bill through. Now they're demanding that the final compromise look more like the Senate measure. Today, CEOs from Bank of America, Citigroup, and more go before Congress next hour to defend how their companies used federal bailout funds.
Well, that should be entertaining.
We'll see. Yeah, we can tune in about half an hour. But they gave a prepared statement, kind of a preview of what they're saying. But they're going to say, yes, it helped us make more loans. We didn't take a big, we didn't use the money for bonuses. So we'll see what they have to say under questioning. Also in Congress, a House committee will hear concerns about offshore drilling today. The House will examine where and under what terms development should occur in the future. Yesterday, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar offered a review of offshore oil and gas development. He's basically rejecting the Bush administration plan to start drilling and the waters that are called the Outer Continental Shelf, or what he calls the OCS.
We need to set aside the Bush administration's midnight timetable for its OCS drilling plan and create our own timeline.
So Salazar also wants to see that any energy plan coming up include more renewable energy. So we'll see.
And in a few seconds, we're going to get the market's Wall Street reaction to second day of the financial bailout. It looks like flat opening. Thank you, Mark.
You got it.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. In a moment, a story about how a court decision in one state in a time of economic downturn can have radical implications for communities all across the United States. But first, everyone knows that public radio listeners are some of the most observant people on the planet. And so we are mobilizing you as Takeaway listeners to watch the shovels in the economic stimulus bill. If the money flew from D.C. directly into your community, how would you spend it? What in your town desperately needs the money? Your roads, your schools, yourself. The biggest bang for your buck as you see it. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. It is your money, after all. Isn't that true? Joining us now is Rose Braz, who's a campaign director of Critical Resistance, a national organization that advocates for alternatives to prison. And here in the studio is Mark Maurer, executive director of the Sentencing Project, a national criminal justice reform program. Mark, thanks for joining us. Rose, thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
So, Rose, let's talk about this decision that was handed down this week. A panel of judges in California ruled that the state of California must reduce its prison population by as many as 57,000 prisoners because health care for those prisoners is inadequate. Explain this court decision and what it's going to mean for organizations like yours.
Well, you know, these cases that have come to this point have been going on literally for over a decade. And the courts have issued order after order after order for the state to improve its what have been just horrendous conditions of confinement, particularly around health care and mental health care. And it actually got to the point where we had one prisoner per week dying unnecessarily, the court found. And so we've come to a point where, very significantly, the court has ordered that the only solution to this problem is to reduce the number of people in prison. And now we're at the point where we need to really push that to happen. And obviously the state is pushing back and saying they're going to appeal it and moving forward with planned prison construction in the light of this court order that says prison construction is not an answer to this problem.
If 57,000 prisoners are released in the state of California, what alternatives to incarceration, what sorts of alternative programs are there available, and are resources adequate to deal with this kind of an influx?
Well, you know, there is no shortage of ways to reduce the number of people in prison in this state and in other states. What there has been a shortage of, the political will to do anything about this huge problem we face. You know, in fact, the court pointed to corrections' own expert panels, which have already recommended a combination of increasing credits and parole reform that would reduce the number of people in prison out here by about 40,000. So there's just no shortage. Parole comes to mind as a real way to do it, particularly here in California, where we send upwards of 60,000 people to prison every year for violations of parole.
Mark Maurer here in New York. What are the implications of this decision for prisons in communities nationwide?
Well, I think people are looking at this decision very carefully, but it really comes at a time, because of the fiscal crisis that all states are facing right now, that states are looking to depopulate their prisons anyway.
And that's because they don't have the money to finance new prisons, or they just can't afford to keep the prisons running?
They can't afford to keep the prisons that they have. Prisons over the last 20 years have become a very significant item in state budgets. We've seen a quadrupling of the population in prison, and much of that has been, I think, acknowledged now as very excessive. You know, we incarcerate people for low-level drug offenses for 5, 10, 20 years in many cases. Many people incarcerated for property offenses. People who either do not need to be in prison, could be supervised in community, or else are serving excessively long sentences, and policymakers are looking at that.
If, as you suggest, Mark, the boom times for prisons are over and that we're in a period of a significant downturn, are the resources there to provide alternatives and non-incarceration counseling programs to mitigate the impact on communities of thousands and thousands of people being in communities?
Well, it's certainly a challenge. I mean, part of the answer is, by closing down expensive prisons, we can supervise and provide services to people in the community at far less cost than incarceration. Part of this also builds on the prison reentry movement of the last 10 years, where corrections officials are increasingly recognized that we need to prepare prepare people for release back into the community. 95% of the people we sent to prison come home someday. We need to better prepare them to enter the world in a legitimate lifestyle.
Rose Bras, I can already sort of hear the Lou Dobbsian shriek or the O'Reilly rant about communities at risk. The government is just going to let these criminals go wandering through town. What's your answer to that argument?
Well, you know, we already release 11,000 people from prison every month in this state. Governor Ronald Reagan, who was by no means a radical, ordered an early release program to address overcrowding here in the 60s. There's a nationwide study by the National Council on Crime and Delinquency that looked at early release programs around the country that have been implemented and concluded they did not jeopardize public safety. So, I mean, this fear factor is definitely out there. I don't think it's based on history or reality. And I also think we need to really look at our limited state resources and how we invest those resources in the future really reflects our priorities and reflects the kind of communities and society we want to build.
So we can't afford to be putting the kinds of people in prison that we were in the past. Mark Maurer, last word. How much of this involves the justice system changing the way it approaches inputs to reduce the number of people who actually go to prison in the first place?
Well, I think we're seeing that, in terms of drug policy, sentencing policy, legislators are reconsidering some of the harsh policies of the last 20 years, the war on drugs, mandatory sentencing and the like, and recognizing that if we're much more proactive, if we invest in prevention, in treatment, in building communities, we can prevent crime in the first place and avoid some of the excesses that we've seen over the last 20 years.
Possible infrastructure spending there. Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project, thanks for joining us. And Rose Bras, watching the decision in California, which may result in the release of 57,000 or more prisoners because of inadequate health care. Rose Bras, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Rose Bras is campaign director for the organization Critical Resistance. Now in for Femi Okay, we've got Mark Garrison.
Thank you. 21 minutes before the hour, and new numbers out today show the U.S. trade deficit fell to the lowest level in nearly 6 years for the month of December. The recession kept demand for imports low. The trade deficit for all of 2008 fell for a second straight year. Economists expect an even bigger drop this year. Meanwhile, the slump in demand that's part of that meant China's exports also plunged. The exports there fell 17.5% last month compared with the previous January. Also, the top executive of Peanut Corporation of America, that's the company at the heart of the salmonella investigation, appears before Congress today. Its ingredients are used by dozens of food companies. The FDA says the company's Georgia plant knowingly shipped tainted goods. The company says it's conducting its own investigation. We've got a link to the list of recalled items at our website, thetakeaway.org. Minnesota is still one senator short. You may have noticed that when you were listening to the vote counts in the stimulus bill and such. Democrat Al Franken and Republican Norm Coleman are still in a court fight over who won. Yesterday, judges ordered 23 previously rejected absentee ballots to be opened and counted. They belong to voters who sued to have them added to the race. That ruling could pave the way for more ballots like those to be looked at and counted. Also, Afghan officials say dozens are dead after multiple attacks on government buildings in Kabul. Attackers struck government buildings and also the Justice Ministry, which they actually occupied for a few hours before being killed by security forces. This, of course, ahead of Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke's visit to the region.
And also, possible number from the Obama administration of how many new troops will
could
be going
be in a few
to
days.
Afghanistan.
Yep.
Thank you, Mark Garrison.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And Donna Metriger is a first-time voter. She's originally from Chicago. But Donna, your first-time vote was not cast for anyone named Barack Obama, was it?
No, I'm in Israel.
All right. Joining us from Beersheba, Israel, is Israeli first-time voter Donna Metriger, who voted in the election. The polls are closed. It appears that there's an inconclusive result. But you know who you voted for, right, Donna?
Yes, I do.
Who was it?
I voted for Netanyahu.
In the Likud party. That's the party that will attempt to try to form a center-right coalition.
Yeah.
Why did you vote for Likud?
I was really discouraged with the behavior of the government we have right now.
Was that because of the corruption charges which brought down Ehud Olmert? Or is it more a matter of really the difficulty of getting anything done in Israel?
You get the nail right on the head. They start one. Okay, first he was going to make peace. Then he let them build up the settlements. Then they started a war, and then they pulled the troops out. You just put it beautifully. The words you said, it's not stable. It's not strong.
And of course,
which is what Netanyahu promised us, a strong government.
But will he have any better success? And I don't want to necessarily cast you as an analyst, but as we know, everyone's an analyst in Israel. Will he have a better chance of putting together a coalition that could be decisive?
Apparently, he already was able to do that and to keep Livni from becoming prime minister from a majority vote in her party. So I guess, yeah, I guess he can.
What's your assessment of the main difference between the Israeli government's difficulties in getting anything done and the problems of bipartisanship in the United States?
Oh, I think you get a lot more done in the United States. And I don't mean to sound prejudiced because I'm an American citizen, but it's true. Because you don't have these huge coalitions. About 30% of the seats were taken up this time by Orthodox Jewish organizations. And I may be wrong, but I think all of them are against peace. And all of them are for settlements, or at least a lot of them are. So right there, you can't make peace, period, because one-third of the people won't agree with you.
Is the peace process the most important issue for you, Donna Metriger?
Well, no, not really. As a matter of fact, maybe it's just as well. I think maybe we need to sit on the peace right now. We had too many problems with Hamas. I'm really concerned about Hamas more than security, more than peace.
And in your neighborhood, in Beersheba, even though it's quite a ways from the border with Gaza, there were missiles that landed near your community, correct?
There were missiles that landed a few blocks away from me and put shrapnel through the head of a 7-year-old boy.
Coming from Barack Obama's hometown, do you think the Israeli government or the Israeli people are looking to this new administration for some help or sign of leadership as far as the peace process is concerned?
Well, I think we always get that to be honest with you, from what I can tell, you know, keeping track of the news, for the last few presidents, at least, if not all the presidents in the United States, do try to support the peace process. And they do try to get involved in it with Israel that way.
Well, it appears that the Obama administration wants to be much more aggressive than has been the policy over the last 8 years. 3 years in Israel, first-time voter, Donna Metriger, a voter for Benjamin Netanyahu, watching the situation for us in Beersheba. David Israel. Thank you, Donna.
You're welcome.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Early market action on Wall Street. Everything's flat to slightly up, but in for Femi Okay, Mark Garrison has the headlines.
Thank you, sir. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, lawmakers may reach a deal today on President Obama's economic stimulus package. The Senate approved its bill yesterday. Now lawmakers have to hash out differences between it and the House bill that passed 2 weeks ago. The bills, of course, have to match before the president can sign the stimulus into law. House and Senate makers, along with White House reps, worked on it through last night. They say they may reach a compromise bill today. Our partners at the New York Times report Sirius XM Satellite Radio is preparing for possible bankruptcy. It has hired advisors to help prepare for the process. It's not known how a bankruptcy would affect customers, but according to the Times, service may not be interrupted, but the company may have to part ways with some of its high-priced talent, like Howard Stern and Martha Stewart. Baseball player Miguel Tejada will be in federal court today. The Houston Astros shortstop is expected to plead guilty of lying to Congress about a former teammate's use of steroids. Meanwhile, the FBI is also investigating whether pitcher Roger Clemens lied to Congress last year about using performance-enhancing drugs. Earlier this week, of course, Yankees superstar Alex Rodriguez acknowledged he had used them in the past.
That's huge. Congress is getting back into this in a big way.
Well, they get a little attention when they have those baseball players
yes,
on the Hill.
Indeed.
That's what I got.
All right. Thank you, Mark Garrison, in for Femi. Okay. Joining us now from Paradise Valley, Arizona, is Dilara Hafiz and her son, Imran Hafiz. Dilara and Imran, thanks for joining us. Dilara, the last time you checked on Amazon, now let me know here, what was the sales rank of your book?
Well, actually, I left so early this morning, I didn't get a chance to check, but we have broken the 500 sales rank barrier, which is very exciting.
Which is very exciting for a book with the title The American Muslim Teenager's Handbook. It's something that Dilara wrote. She's a mom. She has two teenage kids, Yasmin and Imran. Imran, her son, is with her there in the studio. And first of all, why did you think that what is needed in America right now is a good handbook for American Muslim teenagers, Dilara?
Well, actually, my children are also the co-authors, and we wrote this book to not only explain the basics of Islam to American Muslims, but also to explain it to the non-Muslims who somehow feel that Muslims are the other, or that we heard so many misconceptions about Islam. We just wanted to put out an entertaining, educational handbook to Islam.
And Imran, quite literally, one of the myths you began to dispel in your own life was that if you're an American Muslim, you can't play soccer in the U.S. because you must be a member of the Taliban. Explain that story.
In like fourth or fifth grade, I was a victim of playground prejudice, I guess you could call it. Of course, hanging around with the guys, trying to play a pickup game of football or soccer or something like that. And, of course, they say, oh, well, you can't play, Imran. And usually that's due to my lack of soccer skills. But this time it was something different. And they said, oh, you can't play because you're in the Taliban. And, of course, the typical fourth grade response is, well, no, I'm not. And the other riposte is, well, how do you know you could be? And it's just the little things like that you encounter in your daily life as an American Muslim that kind of offer a very different perspective. And after a while, I realized that their comments came not from hate, but from ignorance. And if they really knew about what Islam really could be or meant to me, then maybe that they wouldn't say things like that.
Well, one of the things to know about Islam in America is it is one of the fastest-growing religions in the United States. Dilara, how much of your book is about dispelling ignorance as opposed to arguing against people who maybe have an overt distrust and perhaps hatred of the other?
Sure. It's actually quite a bit of both, because the combination of recognizing that Islam is an Abrahamic faith, just like Judaism and Christianity, there's such a diversity of observance and opinion across the faith. And somehow I feel Islam has been portrayed in a very monolithic manner. After 9/11, the extremists dominated the headlines, and there was no room for the moderates to really speak up and say, hang on a moment, we're Americans, we believe in freedom of religion, and we believe in equality and social justice. We just want to be good, productive citizens.
Now, explain how the book is laid out, because there are a couple of great sort of myth dispellers right off the top. For instance, Muslims don't worship Muhammad. Explain that one.
Sure. Muslims worship God, the one God, the God of Abraham, Moses, Jesus. And I think people sometimes hear the word Allah, which is the Arabic word for God. Personally, I don't speak Arabic. Not all Muslims speak Arabic. So in our book, we've used the word God just to dispel that, you know, one misconception right off the bat that Muslims do worship the same God as Jews and Christians.
Imran, if you had it to do differently, you're almost through your teen years. You got a couple more years to go, but you're 17, I understand.
Yep.
What would you do differently? And maybe as a way of kind of portraying this handbook on the air, what advice would you have for American Muslim teenagers to avoid that they could really get wrong easily?
I think that the biggest thing that I had to learn was don't take insults or things like that very personally. Sometimes when someone will say things that are, I mean, I've heard things like, you know, Muslims should be executed so they can get to hell faster and things like that. And of course, I mean, when you hear something like that, it's very easy to respond in a very vitriolic manner and say, well, of course, that's ridiculous. That's crazy. What are you talking about? And to some extent, I may have responded like that, but then if you respond with the same kind of fervor, then it stops progress because people are too worried about how the other person hurt their feelings.
Sure,
or something
sure.
Like
well,
that.
Delara,
so
let me
take things personally, I guess.
And from the non-Muslim side, there's plenty in here to dispel myths and to make people feel good about this so-called other. There's selections in the book every couple of pages. Calling all teens. Here's a question: do you guys really fast? And one 12-year-old from Texas says yes every day of Ramadan. I started when I was 9. And Julia, age 12, from Arizona, says yes, not a lot, but this year I'm going to try to fast for the whole month. I mean, you can sort of get a sense of the characters and the kids behind these issues that maybe seem a little bit mysterious to American Christians who probably never fast.
Well, exactly. I mean, we just wanted to show the diversity of observance. And also, I think it's so important to promote an interfaith dialogue in this country. America is a pluralistic nation, as we heard our president remind us of that fact. There are Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, Christians, atheists. And I think in order to really have a more productive civil dialogue, it does behoove us to learn a little bit about each other. We'll be so surprised to see the commonalities.
How do you handle the hard questions that I imagine from watching the news non-Muslims and Muslims alike are going to have about where does this stuff come from when they see so much violence around the world?
Well, I have been asked, where is Osama bin Laden hiding? And that was an easy one to say. I have no idea where he is. But I think a lot of these questions just stem from this portrayal that we see on TV that Muslims are somehow extremists. And that's such a narrow sliver of the faith. We can't let extremists from any faith dominate the dialogue, because then there's just no hope of moving forward peacefully.
Imran, before we go, what are your plans after high school?
Oh, boy. Well, I'm hoping to go to college. I'm not quite sure where. Harvard, if you'll take me, I'm here. I'm very interested in either doing something with the medical field or something in public policy.
Your son, the doctor, Delara, do you think he has much of a chance?
Oh, he's constantly lecturing us about medicine, so yes, I think he'd be great.
Well, he's already the co-author of the American Muslim Teenager's Handbook with his mother, Delara Hafiz. Imran Hafiz and Delara Hafiz, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, John, for having us.
Thank you.
Delara Hafiz and her son Imran Hafiz joined us from Paradise Valley, Arizona. We're following the massive economic stimulus bill as Congress irons it out. But if the money flew directly from Capitol Hill into your hands, how would you spend it? We've heard from many of you that the money should go directly to the people, but there are a few people having second thoughts.
Hi, I'm Nora. When I first heard the idea of giving bailout money to people instead of to the corporations, I thought it sounded like a great plan. But when you think about it, what would happen is that we'd get horrible, horrible inflation. And it'd be like $300 for a yogurt or something like that. So anyway, sounded nice to begin with.
Amateur economists, we could use a few more of those. Thetakeaway.org or 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us where the biggest bang for your buck should be in this stimulus package. We are enlisting you as our reporters, you know, to help us dig up more on individual projects that are happening around the country. We're enlisting you as shovel watchers. The project is called Shovel Watch. Go to thetakeaway.org to find out more. Your takeaway this morning?
If it's true that the corporation had knowledge that peanut butter was contaminated and was being sold anyway, it kind of puts this problem into another kind of category. It's such a normal outbreak.
Looking for a silver lining in the salmonella outbreak at Peanut Corporation of America? That's Benjamin England, a 17-year-old veteran of the Food and Drug Administration and founder of FDAImports.com. Hearings begin on Capitol Hill into that peanut salmonella contamination. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway